Why is Pope Francis's recently published apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, or The Joy of the Gospel, causing such interest and excitement far beyond the confines of the Catholic Church? What new possibilities does it offer to those engaged in the search for full, visible Christian unity? And can it really usher in a new era of ecumenical springtime, half a century on from the innovations of the Second Vatican Council? Philippa Hitchin put these questions to theologian and author Gerard Mannion, who currently holds the Amaturo Chair in Catholic Studies at Georgetown University. He's also the founder of a group known as the Ecclesiological Investigations International Research Network, which promotes scholarship and dialogue across the broad spectrum of Christian traditions. Mannion begins by sharing his enthusiasm for the innovative qualities of this groundbreaking papal document.
It's positivity, it's energy, and of course, theologians will be as attentive to not just what's being said, but how it's being said. And of course, it's inevitable. Anyone who works in the area of especially ecclesiology or church history will be looking at this, and each pope has their own distinctive style going right back through the centuries. And this is a very distinctive style, and it's a very distinctive and engaging style. And that's one of the reasons why everybody's talking about this document, and not just theologians, and not even just Catholics, and not even just people of a religious persuasion.
It's a particularly personal style, isn't it? Much more so than we've ever seen from any of the other pontiffs.
Absolutely. And, you know, there have been other popes who've sought to stamp their own particular shape and form on their teaching style. You know, and from the 19th century onwards, we especially get, you know, the plethora of encyclicals coming out. Benedict XVI was a theologian himself. He had a very distinctive style in how he shaped his writings, and he took that into his papal teachings as well. But with Francis, it's even more personal. He uses the first person, which is innovative. One of the other things is this document is full of humour. He uses humour to good effect to make serious points, and also to sort of disarm polarisation, not just within the church, but within the world as well. And it's impassioned. And the other personal dimension is he lays bare his own soul in it as well. He talks about his moments of pessimism and when he's sort of lost hope at certain moments, but then the gospel brings him back round. And so he shares his own journey with the people he's trying to speak to in this document as well.
He also includes a lot of quotes from his predecessors and builds, if you like, in some sense, on the teachings that they have already laid down in encyclicals and other documents. How much do you think this is really, though, a radical new vision, and how much does it actually build on past papal teachings?
A lot of people will want to, and have been, will want to speak about continuity, and people have been speaking about continuity. But again, it's almost inevitable a pope will depart from the core focus and agenda of his predecessor because times change and the church changes with it. It preaches the same gospel, but it needs to, by necessity, and Vatican II makes this clear, preach it in a language and a way and a style that's appropriate for the time and place. And there are many similarities between Francis and Pope John XXIII, but Pope John XXIII also began by quoting many of his predecessors as well. And, you know, his very first encyclical was not the most earth-shattering document. But inside even that, there were also many glimmers of hope. Francis's is much more genuinely radical. He draws upon not just his predecessors, he also draws upon teaching documents from the various bishops' conferences around the world. And that's very significant as well. He also will allude to particular saints and the examples of their life. They're a locus of theology as well. The lives of the poor, popular piety, the lessons this has for us. He even quotes Plato in one part. I'm not sure, you know, how often some of the pagan classic authors have been referred to in papal documents. And he's also, you know, Thomas Aquinas is in there, but in a very different way to how Aquinas would be featured, say, in 19th century documents or even more recent papal documents. This document, by necessity, comes out of a perspective that's informed by a very different world and a very different worldview and a very different set of life experiences to what more traditional European contexts will have informed for the popes who've written their documents out of that context. And to a large extent because of that, and also because of what church and the world is crying out for, this document is a radical document. It's not in any sense slavishly following the interpretation, the agenda of any of his predecessors. In fact, in many ways, you could say it's turning around the emphasis from the previous papal documents and teachings to one that's more engaged, one that's more praxis-oriented, and one that's more centered upon compassion at the heart of the gospel. Just like John the 23rd, when he became pope and at the beginning of the Second Vatican Council said, you know, we instead of the stick, we prefer the medicine of mercy. We want to talk about the positive things and what unites people instead of what divides them. Well, Francis is doing the same, but in a very dramatic and new radical way for the 21st century. And that's what's so energizing and different about this document. That's why people are reading a papal document who normally wouldn't even bother to read a news story about a new papal document. How it communicates, what it communicates, and the substance of the message are very new and very real, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, to live is to change, cite John Henry Newman.
There are many, though, who are concerned that it's perhaps moving too far, too fast. What do you see at the basis of these concerns, for example, about expressions like conversion of the papacy?
Yeah, in many ways, actually, there are certain dimensions to this document which are more truly conservative, in the sense that he's getting back to the basics of the gospel. He's also reigniting much of the agenda of Vatican II. For example, there's a lot of allusions and even citations to Lumen Gentium in there, and also Gaudium et Spes. Only a couple of direct citations, but Gaudium et Spes permeates so much of the document. Virtually on every page, you can see the agenda of Gaudium et Spes picked up again. And also, he's picking up other agendas that have been let lie for a few years or more. And this notion of the conversion of the papacy, for example, well, you know, Pope Paul VI introduced the need for a debate on this. John Paul II most definitely did in Autunum Sint. And more recently, there have been ecumenical groups, such as the Group des Dombes, the ecumenical French-speaking Group des Dombes, who've, you know, picked up this agenda and said, you know, there's a need for a debate about teaching authority, the Petrine office and the papacy, and how it can serve the wider church. And so, if you like, there is a dimension of continuity here, but it's continuity that sort of picks up really important things that the church has been trying to grapple with for a long time, and it picks them up in a constructive way. And so, although it's addressed primarily at the outset to people within the Catholic Church, in many ways, there's a much wider message in here, a wider message to other Christians, people of other faiths, and also a wider message to all people of goodwill around the world.
You see it, in fact, don't you, as opening up a whole new series of possibilities on the ecumenical and interfaith front. What kind of reactions have you been hearing so far to this document?
Well, for example, my good friend who is presently running the Ecumenical Institute in the University of Tübingen in Germany, Vladimir Latinovich, read the document and he said, this document makes people want to join in with the Catholic Church in its efforts. And he comes from the Orthodox background. This document is infusing people, nonconformist people, Baptists, Presbyterians, Anglicans, are talking about this document with excitement. And in many ways, that in itself is a sign that the agenda picked up on the need for the conversion of the papacy is already changing. People are once again, for the first time in a few years in more general circles, talking about a positive role for the papacy in the broader Christian church and even beyond the Christian church, that the leadership and the service that this office of the Petrine ministry can give for the world is something that's now seen as positive again. And I think the ecumenical and interfaith agenda within this document is enormously important and enormously positive. There are certain sections that directly address this, but in many respects, it's addressed throughout all of the different sections. So it's not just where he explicitly talks about interfaith and ecumenical dialogue. It's when he talks about enculturation. It's when he talks about respect for the other. It's when he talks about what unites people rather than divides them. And there are subtle things in there that people haven't quite picked up on yet as well. For example, a colleague here mentioned the other day that Francis mentioned the phrase ecclesial communities alongside the notion of churches, which of course was a negative qualitative distinction that came into official ecclesial discourse. There's an allusion to it in Vatican II, but it's not really centre stage there. It's accentuated in the first decade of this century. And it's seen by Christians from other churches as sort of trying to portray that there are certain churches that are authentic churches and there are certain churches that aren't authentic churches. So somebody expressed disappointment that Francis had mentioned that phrase alongside the phrase of churches. He said the document says churches and ecclesial communities. But actually what he's doing is directly citing the compendium of the social doctrine of the church, which is alluding to those other documents going on at the same time in the first decade of the century. What's potentially groundbreaking, and I don't think there's any other way of interpreting this, is towards the end of the document, he actually takes the phrase ecclesial community and makes it his own, but he doesn't use it to refer to other Christians. He uses it to refer to the church in general. Logically speaking, if ecclesial community is used to refer to the church in general, including all of the Catholic Church, it cannot be qualitatively distinctive from the notion of church itself. So what we're seeing here is an ecclesiological and ecumenical departure point from some of the more negative debates in recent times. All of a sudden, the term ecclesial community and church are more or less interchangeable. And there's a lot of positive sentiment that's going to be taken out of that by people involved in ecumenical engagement.
In the light of this, you're organising, aren't you, a conference at the beginning of next year on the hope of ecumenism, very timely under the circumstances.
Yes, absolutely. And Francis has given us all a great Christmas present in bringing a great deal more hope to those endeavours. It's a conference that's going to be held in Oxford in England at Ripon College, Cuddeston, and also Oxford University in April next year, April the 9th to the 11th. And the focus is indeed hope in the ecumenical future. And what we put this into place was really planning to pick up on earlier conferences, one held in Belgrade last summer and the year before in Assisi, where we're trying to look at pathways for ecumenical and interfaith dialogue and dialogue between people of faith communities and other people of goodwill. And we've been seeing a gradual reemergence of positivity and energy into those efforts for dialogue. And so what we really want to do is focus on the importance of hope and the importance of new ways of trying to re-energize the dialogue that's going on among different Christians, people of different faiths, people of faith communities in the wider world. And so we're hoping to gather together people there in April next year to explore some of the positive energy that's being generated by things such as Francis's letter, but also things going on in other churches, other faith communities. The sense that people are moving on from the ecumenical winter that we all became bogged down in, particularly in the 1980s and beyond.